Good evening and welcome everybody to another Wednesday evening interview. This evening we are very happy to have Aya Suvidhana and Aya Nihanika coming with us this evening. Thank you both for coming on.
You're very welcome.
So I'm just going to read a quick biography of Aya Suvidhana. So Aya Suvidhana started with Zen meditation in 1976. After discovering Vipassana in 1998, she visited Abhayagiri, where she became a disciple of Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano, eventually becoming a monastic student of Aya Tathaloka in 2006. Taking full ordination in 2010, she helped establish Dhamma Dharini Monastery before traveling and teaching since 2020. So.
And Aya Nihanika is a fully ordained Buddhist monastic in the Theravada tradition. Aya uses they-them pronouns and received their initial monastic training within the Dhammadharini community from 2014 through 2019, and then was with the Aloka Vihara community for 3 years. The past year and a bit have been a time of travel, integration, and deepening in practice. They visited a variety of monastic and lay communities in the West and in Asia, taking time for retreat and study as well as community involvement. And initially, we are going to have Ayananda Bodhi on this Wednesday, but Ayananda Bodhi and realized that Nihanika and Aya Suvidhana will be moving up to the Northwest imminently, perhaps within a few days. And it just seemed like this perfect opportunity to bring them on to the live stream, introduce them more to the community. And we'll dive into that whole realm in a second, but may I just say on behalf of Ajahn Kovilo and myself, and we're just so happy to hear that we get more monastics up in the Northwest area. So welcome, kind of, soon. And
much appreciation to Ayananda Bodhi offering this too.
Yes.
Yeah. And to say that, you know, this there's been this constellation recently, Aloka Vihara dissolved, as many of you know, and what's constituted in its wake has been Ayahimsa up in Canmore, Ayananda Bodhi in Port Townsend, and now Aya Suvidhana and Aya Nihanika are contemplating and intending to move to Olympia. And so we just, Aya Nihanika spent several months on Bainbridge near our community before. Aya Suvidhana, I believe, lived in the Northwest for quite a time, and her son lives here as well. And so we thought this would be just a great chance to kind of speak about the aspiration you both have. So acknowledging that, you know, we have a bit of audio lag and all those things, people can bear with us. The first question, tell us, Ayas, what is Pasadi Vihara, and what are your aspirations for this project? Describe it for us.
So are we muted?
No, we're not muted.
Okay. Well, I had this vision while I was traveling of, because I've been visiting various monastic communities, and to have a vihara that was dedicated to seclusion a little bit more than what I'd been seeing, what was available, where I could go in this female form. I was seeing quite a lot of engagement. I mean, it's wonderful, it's beautiful, but I was feeling more seclusion than what I was seeing. So we're hoping to create something that had a balance of contact with community at large, the lay and other monastics, but really to have an environment that supports seclusion. I wrote up a document shared with the Ajahns here, maybe 2 years ago or something like that, in the midst of my travels. And I just was sharing it with mostly with other monastics and I was at Empty Cloud for about 7 months. And during that period of time, I'd shared it with Aya Nyanika, who was in Belgium at the time. She was interested. She emailed me back after looking at the document, and she said, "Let's have a Zoom and do some idea building." And I went, "Oh," she's interested. And I had some kind of romantic fantasy about the East Coast, but it didn't seem to be materializing there, even though I was, you know, trying to make some contact about it while I was there. But I got the most positive response from Aya Nyanika. And then while we were Zooming, I asked her, "What do you think about Washington State?" And she was, yes, much on board with that. So since they, excuse me, since they had the Vasa there and had a good experience there, we thought it was a good opportunity and just to network. This is another thing, to network with other monastics is high on our list, is a part of the reason to be in that area. We do want to share Dhamma, but we, in balance with our monastic, create a situation that supports enough seclusion enough to support bhavana, to support liberation of the heart. Mm-hmm. And we came together on the name Pasadi Vihara. I was thinking about the Pacific, because the Pacific Northwest is often how the region referred to, and Pacific. So I was thinking, I see Samatha, and then I thought, Pasadi. And that really kind of rings along with Pacific too. It's a kind of similar sound, but there's a, it's usually translated as tranquility, but there's also a serenity and calm. The idea of peacefulness was just really resonating in my heart. So I started talking to Aya Nyanika, and then I was telling her or them my process. And then as soon as I was about to say Pasadi, that word came out of her mouth. So that's how the name came.
Yeah.
It was just a few days ago that we
out on a walk here.
So it's the idea has been kind of pie in the sky for a while. And now it's starting to get a little bit more. It's a virtual vihara at this point. Mm-hmm. It's starting to kind of materialize it, at least in the a little bit more concrete idea stage and planning stages. And we're heading north on the 23rd.
We'll depart on the 23rd.
Yes.
If that's Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
And arrive on the 24th, actually go all the way up to Seattle, because the person hosting us, the person we'll be staying with for the first week, Capitol Hill.
Yeah, well, Ajahn Nisibo and I can certainly sympathize with having a virtual monastery. I mean, that's in many ways what Clear Mountain is at the moment. And yeah, the name, Pasadi Vihari, Vihara, the dwelling of tranquility. That's, it's a beautiful name. I'm curious if you could say more about the structure. I mean, the word hermitage, it's an English word, and there's the Pacific Hermitage with Ajahn Sudanto, and the word conjures up some kind of ideas, maybe like a grass roof. I know Westerners, it's not really clear what that looks like, and we have some models, but I'm curious what other models you might, the two of you might be looking at in terms of building off of and kind of shaping the vision around?
We didn't initially pick hermitage in the name itself. Not sure what will emerge further on, but the thought of like Karuna Buddhist Vihara's hermitage or Aranya Bodhi hermitage, where we've been at both of those places, the amount of caretaking of the property that's involved is quite a lot. So we certainly initially would not be even considering that. And so we something that's more in town, but not in kind of that area that the Buddha talked about being a good distance from the town, but not too far. Something that would have nature with it. So we have that hermitage quality without it being so secluded that people, it's not accessible. So that's kind of the footprint. And then the model of seclusion, also that it's accessible for alms, but would have big swaths of the day for secluded practice. So perhaps a time that people could come and offer a meal, we would have some Dhamma interactions, and then we would have good chunks of time for bhavana and internal development.
So
just to...
Can I say a few more words?
So I was going to ask you to say a few more words. Please do. Yes.
Thank you. But it needs to be in stages, and we may have to be closer to town initially, and something extremely simple, rental or something, and then eventually it might develop into something. My vision was something, a small town, outskirts of town, a little so far that we couldn't get to a bus. So it's kind of but we thought about the Pacific Northwest, and there is a lot of outlying areas that are on bus routes that we can be, instead of people coming for like a venue, we would go to some venue. Mm-hmm. For our public contact. And then I was at Dhammasara for just a week in 22. And they had their gate shut from 10. It was open. The gate was open at 10 a.m. and it closed at 2. And so that was the window of time where people could come and offer alms and things like that. Spend time at the monastery, but the gate at 2 o'clock, every day was shut. And I thought, oh, well, just having hours would provide seclusion where if people came to offer a meal, we could still interact, you know, with people, but it would be really defined. This is our time to connect with people. And the rest of the time, and you know, like maybe we would do some kind of venue in town on an evening or a day long or something, but it wouldn't be the pressure on the Vihara itself,
which also helps us to have a small place in Italy. Yeah, that when the outlay could be small.
So to pick up on this emerging picture of the Vihara, would you have any kind of more finer grain detail to give us in terms of how many monastics would you perhaps imagine at some point having there? And in these initial stages, I know that it's, who knows, maybe is the answer, but in these initial stages, how can people support you through these first few weeks, or no, first few months, and then first few years. Let's go for years too.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, we're just kind of possibilities right now. We decided that we're going to just start with us for a while, see what kind of support we get, see if we even Lodging is a big issue. I know that alms food seems to be pretty readily available, but the lodging is the biggest issue. So we just thought, keeping it simple, that we wouldn't have people coming and staying for 2 weeks or something at a time. To house it, house two monastics is a lot more economical. Having a place where we would have a steward and guests and things like that. We're kind of picturing that to start with. Dear Persia, who's on, I think, and I don't know if she wants us to mention her name, but was going and sharing the links to realty sites showing different kinds of three-bedroom homes with a, you know, garage and things like that. That could be like this Vihara where we had people staying, and the garage could be a station hall and all this kind of stuff. But then we realized that kind of premature to think about. So it's going to just start with the two of us for a while and see what kind of support we get in the area. And then from there, it's kind of just going to be growing organically. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it just depends on how things develop.
And the development trajectory would not be going towards people coming for a week or 2 weeks, sort of. It would still be that people were there. We're not looking for, we'll be directing to other places people who are looking for their first taste of Buddhism, looking for people who are aspiring to monastic life, all really care about bhavana, who are looking for a place that would support their seclusion and service mix. So we're really about balance. And so we don't have in the vision that there will be, you know, first time visitors coming in to taste monastic life, that it were folks who are really looking for a place to deepen. And we don't know what the length of a first visit might be, but it's not going to be come for a few days or something.
And then also we were thinking people that already had some time with monastics, that they have they're not completely new to how food is offered or the idea that we're mendicants, even. It's like that
Can I say we've been having fun with a bit quiz?
I don't know if we need to talk about that.
Oh, but, okay, all right, yeah. Well, potentially some fun items coming up to see about alignments and things.
Well, cool. Well, it's great. It'll be great to have more monastics up in the Pacific Northwest. And yeah, I imagine a lot of our community hasn't actually met either of you in person. And I'm curious if, I mean, Ajahn Nisibo and I just read, you know, a brief bio of each of you, but I'm curious, you mentioned just bhavana or development. And I'm curious maybe to hear from each of you, maybe just how would you tell your story about how you came to robes and what has been your sustaining bhavana and keeps your practice alive up until today? So a big, long question, but would love for each of you to be able to introduce yourselves to people in that way. Maybe with Ayasuvijana first. First, with how to spell your name. I've seen it with the macrons, those A's, the lines over the A's in different spaces and different websites.
Unfortunately, so. Yeah, that was misspelled on the originally somehow. And unfortunately, I don't have diacritics on my tablet, so I can't put it in. But so both of them are wrong. Suvijana. Yeah, two long A's. And thank you for the question. Yeah, my history is quite long, a brief, maybe fast forward was, but yeah, I did start in Zen, the Zen tradition. I was, as a teenager, I was interested in, so-called alternative religions. And so I was interested to begin with, and then ethical purifications. And then I had this book, Light on Yoga, and it talked about, this was all about preparing for meditation. And I'm like, how do I do that? And so I happened to meet somebody who was in the Tibetan tradition. He's a student of Trungpa Rinpoche. And so I ended up going to the Naropa Institute. And then there I met a Zen student who introduced me to his teacher. So I had this, like, I was seeking since I was a teenager, you know, like, I didn't like the idea of the dichotomy of heaven and hell. And then, so reincarnation started to say, yeah, that sounds really a much more a reasonable thing to think about. So when I finally encountered Buddhism, it just made all the sense in the world to me. When I read the Four Noble Truths, it just rang true in my heart. And it was like, I could, to a certain degree, understand the first two, the dukkha, the suffering, and the cause, and that made sense to me. And the other two factors, I thought, I need to find this, find a way to that, learn about that, how to practice like that. So I just dove into Zen practice fully in my 20s, and spent a lot of time doing Zazen, the sitting meditation, the just sitting, the Shikantaza practice. I don't say I always mastered it, but and that just seemed right for quite some time. And then as things go, I got married and had a family, got really distracted for a while. And then I felt a calling again. And see, how did that happen? Somehow, I started going to the Vipassana Center in Santa Cruz where I was living. And somebody started reading from the suttas. And I was like, whoa, this is what I've been needing to hear for so long. As I kind of hit a plateau with the Zen practice, and to hear the Buddha, actually the word of the Buddha, you know, the translated word of the Buddha, I just really started to absorb it. Tried to find out ways to learn more about it. And then when I was at Vipassana Santa Cruz, there was a little flyer talking about a fire monastery. And so I asked one of the teachers there, can I go there? And then the information's right there on that fair. Do it. So I did. And after that, I was really inspired to monastic life. But it took a while to figure out in this female form how to go forth. It wasn't, bhikkhuni ordination wasn't apparent. It wasn't, you know. So, but I did feel a strong calling. Mm-hmm. Santusa and I were lay women together going to Abhayagiri, and we're saying, how can we do this? How can we go forth ourselves? So we both found a way to do so. With them to start with, but so that's my long story. And so my bhavana, I continue, meditation is really a stronghold for me, and I sit as much as I can. I have time for sitting, but I also dive into the suttas, read different translations. And And then I feel so grateful for Gato to have the digital form where I can look at it and the English side by side. And so I have a certain amount of, I'm not a Pali scholar or know Pali grammar well, but you know, I have a pretty good vocabulary, I think. And so I can understand a lot of the Pali, and it helps having it side by side, and then also clicking on. It's just really been a wonderful tool to use for my own enrichment, and also asked to share the Dhamma. I use the suttas as my refuge, my reference. I wanted to say reference, but it comes out as a refuge. It's a refuge and a reference. Anyway, so is that an answer?
That's beautiful, yeah, and that's quite a wonderful reference to refuge. And so people know, Ayasuvi Jhana has been giving teachings when she was at Empty Cloud quite often. So if you go to Empty Cloud's YouTube, Buddhist Insights, you'll see many teachings. That's where I first met Aya. And there is really a grounding in the suttas that's pretty wonderful. And we might get them visiting on the 27th, up on a Saturday gathering the week after this too. So in person, live. Mm-hmm. So Aya and Janneke, please let us know your history, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself as well.
Sure. I'm going to really encapsulate before monastic life was I had the perfect lay life by all appearances in many ways, but still it was a dukkha door. And so illness that brought me to the Dhamma. Then when I found the Dhamma and began to see people in robes, like, I wish this were possible. And my teacher said, because I was only seeing bhikkhus, he said, you keep practicing. I've got a bhikkhuni coming in the spring. And my heart lit up and I'm like, oh. So I talked to that particular bhikkhuni and said, you know, my conditions, da da da. And she said, it's difficult, but it's possible. And that was I had managed to get out of my contract and my job, my lease, found a good hat, you know, okay, and was on my way. So it happened pretty quickly. Hang a little bit here, a little bit there, and I was not having it. I was going. And I'm very grateful for that. These last year and a half of going from being in community to visiting communities and traveling and some retreat time, I really missed it. At certain points, it was very nourishing. And at certain points, what I really meant, the delight in the Dhamma. When I was at Ayasuvi Jhana was there, she would come into the kitchen while I was washing dishes and just sutta stories. And I remember it was like the heart leaping at the Dhamma. And I realized the places that I was while traveling had that drinking the Dhamma delight. Ayasuvi Jhana mentioned this potential. It was like, yes, that's where the focus, I want the focus to be on delighting in the Dhamma, in our lives and in the sharings. And so, I mean, there's the Dhammapada that partly is at my to mind is one who drinks of Dhamma happily abides with mind clear, pure, and bright, so Pasadi. In the Dhamma made known by the noble ones, always the wise will delight. So that's been a part of my practice is the cultivavana of factors of delight. So that when I'm sitting, it's joyful. That's been a huge part of it. And then as we're working towards what does the vihara look like, I've been focusing on the English. English, the Palarancha Sarato, Nyata Asarancha Sarato. So it's in the essential, one sees the essential, in the inessential, the inessential. essential. The essential is where the focus is. One realizes the essential. Write samkhapa gochara. So write, I like to say, of mind is the pasture. The bhavana focus is like, how do we find out what's essential for pasadi vihara and for our own practice, and drop some of the stuff that's being done beautifully in other places, or maybe isn't essential for our practice and those who might be aspiring in the way that we are right now.
Thank you for that clarification and just history in general and aspiration. And Ajahn Kovilo, the next time I'm washing my bowl with you nearby, I expect Dharma verses to be recited.
I love that. I love that, Ajahn.
That'll be policy. Okay, deal. So Ayaz, thank you. And we'll have many opportunities to introduce both of you and the project more over these coming weeks and months and hopefully years. But we also wanted to give the audience a chance just to ask some good old-fashioned Dharma questions. So please, if you're watching, just type whatever you'd like to ask in the chat, and we'll begin with a question by Jessica. Ayaz, would you speak about the concept of skillful means and how it can be applied when you need to set a boundary with someone?
Mm-hmm. Should I go? Well, what's skillful is kindness, for one thing. And there are five things to think about before we speak to somebody. And also our attitude of mind. And this is from the simile of the saw. And so when people may speak to us in five courses of speech, and it may be, I don't know if I get it all in the right order, but it may be true or false. It may be timely or untimely. It may be gentle or harsh. It might be useful or useless. And it may be spoken with a heart of loving kindness or inner hate. So no matter how people address us in those five ways, then we should have compassion for that person's welfare. And this is the high bar the Buddha is setting for. Starting with them, pervade all with the heart of loving kindness. But I like this five because also when we respond, we should think about, is our response true or false? So we should try to err on the side of truthfulness as much as we can. And timeliness, so when we're setting a boundary, we should come like really truthfully saying what we need as far as a boundary. In a timely way, find a time when a person would be receptive to that boundary, and speaking it kindly, gently, and also make sure that what we're saying is actually meaningful. You know, that just think of that, because is it really be a benefit to both of us for me to really set this boundary? So is this important thing to do? And then doing it with the heart of loving kindness. So if we, no matter how people are approaching us, to have compassion for them, but also to, I love these five courses of speech because we can use them also as a guideline as how we treat other people. And people may or may not respond the way we want them to. They may not speak to us truthfully about the situation. They may not respond back to you in a timely way. They may not be speaking gently. They may speak harshly. They may bring in a bunch of useless information. So no matter what, and they may be speaking in a hostile manner, we should have compassion for ourselves too. And this is a beautiful thing when we're pervading the all-encompassing world, we're part of that. So we're having compassion for ourselves and loving kind as well as the other person. So so just be honest and clear and gentle. And it also, the timeliness can be like, is it when I'm really upset about the situation? That's not a good time. So it's internal as well as external. So I find, you know, like a time where I've had a moment to really digest the situation and consider what would be the kindest way to approach it and how to be really clear. This is part of the truthfulness, to be really clear that I need to set this boundary. So I hope that's helpful. And do you have anything to add to that?
I could, but I also feel like that's probably enough for the question. I think it's beautiful.
Okay.
It's all right.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Aya. Great, great answer. And obviously a lot to work on for probably the rest of our lives. Next question. It says, hi, Aya's smiley emoji. I thought I saw recently that you both were in Korea not too long ago. Care to speak about any highlights of the trip?
It was just me in Korea. I was down under. So we've been in different places, parts of the world.
But not at the same time.
But not at the same time. So yeah. Highlights of Korea. I'll be brief. One. Because but which one?
If you want.
I'll decide. So the first one was arriving, seeing Aya Suchita, who was when I was at Damadrini, and to be able to spend a month. And we first went to the Sri Lankan temple and spent, it was longer than we'd initially, but it was fantastic. And that I just loved about it was that the beach, I highly recommend the beaches there. Bante Dhamma Kitti is their bhikkhu there. The way that he integrated the bhikkhunis in with the flow there, it was, he just kept saying, we're Mahasangha, we're Mahasangha. And it felt so reassuring, especially after just having come from Thailand and navigating gender and bhikkhu and bhikkhuni. And it was just lovely to be just there in the Dhamma Sangha. So that aspect of it. And then in a country where Buddhism goes quite a ways back and it has a different heritage, to be at a Theravada temple was also really feeling like I felt like being nourished by my preceptor having come from Korea and this mentor coming from Korea and the strong training that's there for bhikkhunis. And then the aspect of the Sri Lankan bhikkhus being in the forefront of supporting bhikkhuni ordination. And those two things together were incredibly nourishing. Asia experiencing that. Even to have him say, you know, we've just built the Sima, we're going to have our first bhikkhu ordination, it's ready for. It just was so nourishing. And then the other one was visiting Ayatathaloka's preceptor, her initial mentor. and who's, I think, 90 something. And just an amazing presence. Just, I couldn't speak the language, but that sense of and lifting and support and connection, and to see the university and the training, and gave me a lot of encouragement for what is possible. Sangha works together. So those were two of many highlights to pick.
Thank you, Aya. That's perfect. We have a bagel in the chat. This is one of Ajahn Kobilo's brilliant mnemonics. Beneficial, accurate, bagel? Gentle, expedient, and with loving kindness. It's a way of remembering proper speech. With the counterpoint of the donut. Ajahn Kobilo, do you have the donut memorized?
Let's see. It's deleterious. It's the N is noxious. The U is untimely. And the T is treacherous. And the O is obviously false. Yeah, there we go.
This is one thing we all get with Ajahn Kobilo is the best mnemonics out there. So bagels, not donuts, people. Thank you, Ajahn.
So I do.
Back to business. good. Ayaz, do you ever get discouraged about your practice, and how would you work with that?
I don't know that I get discouraged. I know there are obstacles. I have to recognize that there are obstacles. What's really beautiful, tools we can use to deal with different situations of the mind, and even like things like doubt, or what was the actual question? That was a
discouragement.
Discouraged, yeah. I guess it could, doubt would come up if you were discouraged. I don't get discouraged about practice itself, but maybe like, or even the world. I could be discouraged about the world, but then I think, oh, this is the nature of this, where we are. And have compassion. My being upset about it, or my being about it, isn't going to change that. So this is how it is with the mind too. I could be discouraged because it seems like this is arising in the mind. Mm-hmm. It's like, and again, and how many meditating, there it is again. So that could be discouraged. It's just like patience is the highest ascetic practices. Yeah. So being patient and just saying, okay, this is just the nature of the mind, and being aware of even being discouraged helps. and I usually just, sometimes I go and I just start reading the suttas and get inspired. And it's in me, and I'll have to confess. Sometimes I'll listen to Ajahn Brahm's public talks where he's telling a lot of jokes, and you know, and so I listen to that, and I get some laugh, and then he'll hit us with some really in the midst of all the humor and such, and it's often surprising too. Tuning into either a talk or even opening up, I've opened up the Samyutta Nikaya, and then just gone to what I needed to read. Somehow, maybe the teaching is just so, all of it's relevant or something, but it just like strikes me. So if I feel a little bit of discouragement, it doesn't last long. So I'm quite inspired by the path, and so there's always something that's going to help me if I just open my heart to it. So in the Dhamma. So
I think for me it's fairly similar. Discouragement, that exact word is probably not one I would use. I would say when it comes, it is not frequent, and there are other words I might use. And the reason is the courage, to go into robes, to really live the monastic life, to do this for the right ending of suffering. It takes some tenacity, it takes some courage. It's what I see in all of the people here and many of the monastics I've lived with most. That's not something that tends to be a deficit quality aspect, but that sense of a world weary, like really here, and be that moment of, oh, and then what tends to arise now in my practice is, oh, of course it's like this. You know, this is that a lot. This is samsara. We're not fixing samsara. We are practicing for the ending of suffering. And in the process, we can help alleviate suffering in the world, but we aren't, you know, stop. So if I'm discouraged about the state of the world, it's not fixed that. It's not possible. It's insane. Whereas it is possible. The Buddha's given us the way. It is possible to practice for the ending of suffering. So I use a lot too. Liberation is possible. Liberation is possible, yes. Is my antidote for discouragement.
That was a beautiful answer, both of you. And Pasadi Vihara, may it be one more kind of step of maybe making samsara a little better while we're all in it, and lead many beings toward that end of suffering. And really, I know it, we know firsthand it can take quite a bit to set off into the wilderness of the Northwest, and just wishing you both all the best, and we'll make sure to bring you onto the community as much as we can, and wish you both, you know, good luck. And I, Yannicka, and I, Suvijana, will be joining us on Zoom after this, for those who want. We'll be pasting the link into the chat. I think Kobilo will be doing that for those who want a more intimate discussion. We'll also probably be joined by them the Saturday after this one in person. And Aya is just so grateful. Ajahn Kobilo, anything?
Yep. Thank you, Venerables. And we'll hopefully see as many of you as are able over on Zoom. So have a good night, everybody.